Unless otherwise indicated, Ratchet Book Club is intended for a mature audience. Viewer discretion is greatly advised. Ratchet Book Club, hood classics, good classics, toast. I like toast. Strawberry jam, little bit of butter, perfect. Like, really. But important to know, making toast in the oven with the butter already on it hits differently than making toast in a toaster. Of course, one reason is because the bottom is going to be soft and the top is toasted, which honestly should taste weird, but it tastes fucking fantastic, especially if you go ahead and you put like the strawberry jelly on the soft side and you make like a toasted jelly sandwich with the butter on the outside and the jelly and the peanut butter, and I'm fat. 916-633-1537, ratchetandratchet@gmail.com, Ratchet Book Club on Twitter, Ratchet Book Club on Facebook. I'm not fat because of that sandwich. I play sports. I could have ran that off. I am fat because of my body type. It's just the way I am right now. That's it. Chapter 23. 6 weeks later, Lori Lynn Hicks came to dinner. She looked prettier than Pomme de Sauvignon. Never at any meal previously had I spent so little time admiring the food on my plate. Candles in ruby red, crystal-cut chimneys cast soft, trembling geometrics on the silk moire walls and shimmering amber circles on the coffer mahogany ceiling. She outshone the candlelight. Over the appetizer, sesame baked crab, my father said, "I've never known anyone whose mother is a snake handler." "A lot of women take it up because it sounds fun," Lori said, "but it's a lot harder than they think. Eventually, they give it up." "But surely it's still fun," my mother said. "Oh, yes. Snakes are great. They don't bark, they don't claw the furniture, and you'll never have a rodent problem." "And you don't have to walk them," Mom added. "Well, you can if you want, but it freaks out the neighbors. Maddie, this crab is fabulous." "How does a snake handler make money from it?" Dad wondered. "Mom has developed three primary revenue streams. She provides a variety of snakes to movie and television productions. There, for a while, it seemed every music video used snakes." My mother was delighted. "So she rents out the snakes?" Dad asked, "By the hour? By the day? By the week?" "Usually by the day. Even a snake-heavy movie only needs them for maybe 4 or 5 days. And you know, where the fuck did they get all those snakes for Snakes on a Plane? Where'd they get all them motherfucking snakes for that motherfucking plane?" These are the questions that you have to wonder about when you're reading about people talking about snake handlers. Like, most of them had to be fake snakes, right? Fake snakes? You know, like CGI snakes? Not AI. We don't. But CGI snakes, most likely, you think? I think. Okay, we think it together. "There isn't a movie these days that wouldn't be improved by a lively bunch of snakes," Grandma Rowena declared. "Especially that last Dustin Hoffman thing." "People who rent snakes by the hour," Lori said somberly, "are for the most part not reputable." This intrigued me. I've never heard of a disreputable snake rental company. "Oh, they're around all right," Lori grimaced. "Very tacky outfits. They rent to individuals by the hour, no questions asked." Mom, Dad, and I exchanged baffled looks, but Weena knew the score. For erotic purposes. Dad said, "Yuck," and Mom said, "Creepy," and I said, "Grandma, sometimes you scare me." Lori wanted to make one thing clear. My mother never rinsed snakes to individuals. When I was a child, Weena said, little Ned Yarnell, the boy next door, was bit by a rattlesnake. A free snake or a rented one? Dad asked. Free. Little Ned didn't die, but he got gangrene. They had to amputate, first a thumb and a finger, then everything to the wrist. Jimmy, dear, Mom said, I'm so glad we didn't have to cut your leg off. Me too. Dad raised his wine glass. Let's drink to our Jimmy not being an amputee. After the toast, Weena said, Little Ned grew up to be the only one-handed bow and arrow champion ever to compete in the Olympics. Amazed, Lori said, that isn't possible. Dear girl, Weena said, if you think there are lots of one-handed Olympic bow and arrow champions, you can't know much about the sport. Of course he didn't win gold, Dad clarified. A silver medal, Grandma admitted, but he would have won the gold if he had two eyes. Putting down her fork to punctuate her astonishment, Lori said, he was a cyclops? No, my mother said. He had two eyes. He just couldn't see out of one of them. But don't you need depth perception to be good at something like the bow and arrow? Lori wondered. Proud of her childhood friend, Weena said, Little Ned had something better than depth perception. He had spunk. Nothing could keep Little Ned down. Picking up her fork again, taking a last morsel of crab from her plate, Lori said, I'm fascinated to know if Little Ned might have also been a dwarf. What a peculiar but somehow charming idea, my mother said. Just peculiar in my book, Grandma disagreed. Little Ned was 6 feet tall by his 11th birthday and wound up 6 feet four, a big lug like our Jimmy. No matter what my grandmother thinks, I'm inches shorter than Little Ned. I probably weigh a lot less than he did, too, except that the comparison is limited to hand weight, in which case I would have a considerable advantage over him. Comparing my own two legs, my left weighs more than my right by virtue of the two steel plates and the numerous screws that now hold the femur together, plus the single steel plate in the tibia. The leg required considerable vascular surgery as well, but that didn't add an ounce. At dinner there in early November 1994, the wound drains were no longer in place, which improved the way I smelled, but I still wore a fiberglass cast. I sat at the end of the table, stiff leg thrust out to one side, as if I hoped to trip Grandma. Weena finished her crab, smacked her lips in the flamboyant manner that she believed is the right of anyone her age, and said, You mentioned your mama makes snake money three ways. Lori patted her wonderfully full lips on her napkin. She also milks rattlesnakes. Appalled, my dad said, What kind of supermarket from hell would sell such stuff? We had a cute little milk snake lived with us for a while, Mom told Lori. His name was Earl, but always thought Bernard would suit him better. He looked like a Ralph to me, Grandma Rowena disagreed. Earl was a male, Mom said, or at least we always assumed so. If he had been a female, should we have milked him? After all, if you don't milk a cow, it could end up in terrible distress. The evening was off to a splendid start. I hardly had to say anything. I looked at Dad. He smiled at me. I could tell he was having a wonderful time. There's not actually milk in a milk snake, Lori said. None in a rattler either. What my mother milks out of them is venom. She gets a grip behind the head and massages the poison glands. The venom squirts out the fangs, which are hypodermic in rattlers, and into a collection beaker. Because he considers the dining room to be a temple, Dad rarely puts an elbow on the table. He put one on it now and rested his chin in his hand as though settling in for a long listen. So your mother has a rattlesnake ranch. Ranch is too grand of a word, Rudy. So is farm for that matter. It's more of a garden with just the one crop. My grandmother let out a satisfying belch and said, Who does she sell this venom to? Assassins or maybe those pygmies with blowguns? Drug companies need it to make anti-venom. And it has a few other medical uses. You mentioned a third revenue stream, my father reminded her. My mother's a real ham, Lori said with affection. So she takes party bookings. She has this fantastic act with the snakes. Who would book such an act? My father wondered. Who wouldn't? My mother asked, probably already thinking ahead to their anniversary party and Weena's birthday. Exactly, Lori said. All kind of corporate affairs like retirement parties, Christmas parties, bar mitzvahs, the American Library Association, you name it.
You name it!
Mom and Dad removed the appetizer plates. They served bowls of chicken corn soup with cheddar crisps on the side. I love corn, Grandma said, but it gives me flatulence. I used to care, but I'm not obliged to anymore. The golden years rock. Raising a toast, not with wine, but with his first spoonful of soup, Dad said, here's hoping that bugger doesn't weasel out of a trial. Here's hoping he fries. The bugger, of course, was Punchinello Bizzo. The following morning, he would attend a preliminary hearing to determine if he was mentally fit to stand trial. He had gunned down Lionel Davis, Honker, Crinkles, and Byron Metcalf, a longtime leader of the town's preservation society, whom he had tortured to obtain information about access to the passageways under the town square. In addition, the explosion had killed two members of a cleaning crew at work in the courthouse, and a homeless person assessing the treasures of a dumpster behind the library. Martha Faye Jeter, an elderly widow living in an apartment in a building next door to the courthouse, had also perished. 8 is a heavy toll in human life, but considering the extent of the destruction, scores of victims might have been expected. Lives were spared because the explosions were 2 stories underground, and some of the force vented into the subterranean tunnels. The library, the mansion, and the bank imploded, crashing down into their cellars and subcellars as though brought to ruin by the precise formulations of a demolition expert. The courthouse largely imploded as well, but its bell tower toppled into the building next door, bringing sudden fury into the quiet life of the widow Jeter. Her 2 cats were also squashed. Some citizens of Snow Village seemed to be angrier about this outrage than either the human or architectural losses. Ain't that the truth? Y'all niggas get weird about some weird things or get mad about some weird shit. Like, for real, for real. And it's like, y'all get madder about a dog than you do about a life. And I've seen this happen in real time. Like, you'll get mad about a dog not getting fed the right type of food. And you won't get mad about a person being murdered, a kid being abused, a person in a domestic violence situation. You won't give a fuck about that, but you care so much about this dog or this cat or this fish. And I know PETA's out there, and I understand that they have their things that they care about. That's cool. But nah, just be concerned about everybody. And for y'all folks who are still like, y'all don't say all lives matter, you say Black Lives Matter. No, we're not going to get into that shit right now. Fuck you. Donate for thinking that shit. Punchinello had expressed regret that hundreds hadn't died. I'm sorry. To come back to that sentence right after talking about how all lives and all that, just, okay. He told police that if he could do it all over again, he would add packages of napalm to ensure a firestorm that would devastate many square blocks. Portions of the street and the park subsided into Cornelius Snow's secret passageways. My fine black sporty coupe with the yellow racing stripes had been swallowed by one of these sinkholes. Remember when I said I hadn't met a young woman whom I could love as much as I loved that 7-year-old Dodge Daytona Shelby Z? Funny thing. I didn't mourn the loss of it. Not for a minute. Although Lori would have looked good in the Shelby Z, she would look even better in a 1986 Pontiac Trans Am. Not black, but maybe red or silver. A color to match her exuberant spirit. Or a 1988 Chevy Camaro IROC Z convertible. My problem, however, was one that any young baker on a bread and cake wage could appreciate. There were men in the world who, upon getting one look at her, would buy Lori a Rolls Royce for every day of the week, and not all of them would look like trolls. You don't think they'll send the bugger to some asylum and let him off the hook, do you? Dad asked. He doesn't want that himself, I said. He's saying he knew exactly what he was doing, and it was all about revenge. He's crazy in his way, Lori said, but he knows right from wrong as sure as I do. Maddie, Rudy, this soup is fantastic, even if it causes flatulence. Grandma Rowena had a relevant story. Hector Sanchez lived over there by, near Bright Falls. He killed himself with a fart. The rationalist in my father was stirred by Grandma's assertion. Weena, that's just not possible. Hector worked in the hair oil industry, Grandma recalled. He had beautiful hair, but not much common sense. This was 56 years ago, back in 38, before the war. Even then, it wasn't possible, Dad declared. You weren't even born then. Maddie either, so don't tell me what was and wasn't possible. I saw it with my own eyes. You've never mentioned this before, Dad said, suspecting a fabrication, but not ready to make the accusation. Jimmy, has she ever mentioned this before? No, I confirmed. I remember Grandma telling us about a Harry Ramirez who boiled himself to death, but not this Hector Sanchez. Maddie, do you remember ever hearing this before? No, honey, my mother admitted. But what does that prove? I'm sure it just slipped Mother's mind until now. Seeing a man fart himself to death doesn't just slip your mind. To Lori, Dad said, I'm sorry, dear. Our table talk isn't usually this low. You don't know what low is until you're eating canned ravioli while listening to stories about snake cankers and the smell of a tornado that sucked up the contents of a sewage processing plant. Impatiently, Grandma said, Hector Sanchez never slipped my mind. This is just the first time we've been in a conversation where the subject came up naturally. What was Hector's job in the hair oil industry? Mom asked. If he blew himself up with a fart 56 years ago, Dad said, who cares what he did in hair oil? I'm sure his family cared, Weena said. It put food on their table. Anyway, he didn't blow himself up. That's not possible. Case closed, my father said triumphantly. I turned 21, and my husband, Sam, took me to a tavern for the first time. We were in a booth. Hector was on a bar stool. I ordered a pink squirrel. Do you like pink squirrels, Lori? Lori said yes, and Dad said, you're driving me so crazy with this. I'm seeing pink squirrels right now, crawling on the ceiling. Hector was drinking beer with lime slices, sitting just one stool away from this bodybuilder. He had biceps the size of hams and the prettiest tattoo of a snarling bulldog on his arm. Hector or the bodybuilder? My mother asked. Hector didn't have any tattoos, at least not in any place that was visible. But he had a pet monkey named Pancho. My mother said, was Pancho also drinking beer? The monkey wasn't there. Where was he? Home with the family. He wasn't one of those monkeys that liked running around the gin mills. Pancho was family-oriented. Mom patted Dad on the shoulder. That's my kind of monkey. So Hector, sitting on the bar stool, he cuts a ripe one. At last, my father said, and the bodybuilder takes offense at the smell. Hector tells him to buzz off, except he doesn't say buzz. How big was this Hector? Lori wondered. I'd say about 5'7", 130 pounds. He could have used the monkey for backup, Lori said. So the bodybuilder punches him twice, grabs him by the hair, and smashes his face to the bar three times. Hector falls off the stool, dead, and the bodybuilder orders another Boilermaker, spiked with two fresh eggs for the protein. My father glowed with vindication. So I was right. Passing gas didn't kill him. The drunken bodybuilder killed him. If he hadn't farted, he wouldn't have been killed, Grandma insisted. Finishing her soup, Lori said, so, how did Harry Ramirez boil himself to death? Next came the entree. Roast chicken with chestnut and sausage stuffing, polenta, and snap peas, followed by celery root salad. When, past midnight, Dad rolled in the dessert cart from the kitchen, Lori couldn't make up her mind between a tangerine cream tart and a slice of Genoise. She took both. She sampled the Coeur de Crème, the Badino di Ricotta, and the Mont Blanc Amarons, then chose four items from the three-tier cookie tray. She ate a springerly cookie with intense concentration until she realized that everyone at the table had fallen silent. When she looked up, all of us were smiling at her. "Delicious," she said. We smiled. "What?" she asked. "Nothing, dear," my mother said. "It just seems like you've always been here." Lori left at 1 in the morning, which was early for the Tok family, but late for her. At 9 in the morning, she had to teach 2 angry Hungarians to dance. The angry Hungarians are a story unto themselves. I'll save them for another book if I live to write one. At the front door, as I stood with the aid of a walker, Lori kissed me. This would have been the perfect end to the evening if she hadn't kissed me just on the cheek, and if my entire family had not been 2 feet away, watching and smiling, and, in one case, indulging in too much lip smacking. Then she also kissed my grandmother, my mother, and my father, which didn't make me feel so special anymore. She returned to me, kissed me on the cheek again, and that made me feel somewhat better. When she breezed out the house and into the night, she seemed to take most of the oxygen with her. In her absence, breathing hurt a little. Let me break into this story to tell you that if you don't feel this way about your significant other, please try everything you can to rebuild that flame. I need somebody in this world to feel the way that I feel about my wife. Even in the days where I am so mad at her that I'm just watching her snore blissfully in bed because I can't sleep and she can. And I'm just like, I love you. I love every moment of her life that I've been a part of. I love everything that has led to us meeting. I love every aspect of her being, from ethereal to real. I just love her heart makes music that only I can hear. And her smile elicits sunshine that only others can see. Her brilliance draws people in like a siren song. And her grace leaves people wondering. I'm fucking with you about the grace. She literally ran into a fucking kitchen cabinet, like face first, just blah, 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 twice in a row, my nigga. Like twice. She hit one and then she turned around and she hit the other. Boom, boom. Double tap. It was great. But it was great to laugh at it even now with her. I don't know what love is supposed to be. But if it's what we have, then I'm okay. And if it's not, then I'm okay. What we have is a pleasant little hole in our part of the world where we have conspired together, laughed, cried, and fought together. Watched our kids grow up. Watched over our nieces and nephews. Ate, argued, fucked. Danced. Just looked at each other. We didn't want anything. It's just taking in the richness of our lives together. I pray that each and every one of y'all find what I have. And you find it in abundance. Because this is living richly. I'm sitting here recording a podcast where the book is talking about love. That's what this is to me. Food is love. Family is love. And this wonderful young lady who just fits inside of it all, like she was always supposed to be there. That is the best line in the world. When it feels like you were always here. You were always a part of this. That's magic. That is a beautiful magic that I hope everybody gets to have. And I hope that you get to have it abundantly. Not just in a way that you have to sacrifice something else to get it, but something that is so real and is so flawless that it affects everything in your world and everyone in your world. I hope that for you. Dad was late leaving for work at the resort. He had delayed in order to see Lori off. Before he left, he said, "Son, no self-respecting baker will let that one get away." While Mom and Grandma cleared the dinner table and loaded the two dishwashers, I settled into a living room armchair and leaned my head back against the spider pattern antimacassar. With my stomach pleasantly full and my cast-bound leg raised on a footstool, I felt beached. I tried to read a mystery novel, one in a series about a private detective with neurofibromatosis, the disease made famous by the Elephant Man. He traveled from end to end of San Francisco in his investigations, always wearing a hooded cloak to conceal his deformed features. I couldn't get into the story. With dinner cleanup completed, Grandma returned to the sofa and to her needlepoint. She had begun a centipede pillow. Mom sat at the easel in her alcove and worked on a portrait of a collie whose owner wanted it portrayed in a checkered neck scarf and cowboy hat. Considering my life and the dinner just enjoyed, I naturally gave some thought to eccentricity. As I write about the Tot Clan, its members seem odd and singular, which they are, which is one reason why I love them. Every family is eccentric in its own way, however, as is each human being. Like the Tocks, they have their ticks. Eccentric means off or aside from the ordinary, off or aside from what is considered normal. As a civilization, through consensus, we agree on what's normal, but this consensus is as wide as a river, not as narrow as a high wire above a big top. Even so, not one of us lives a perfectly normal, ordinary life in every regard. We are, after all, human beings, each of us unique to an extent that no member of any other species is different from others of its kind. We have instinct, but we're not ruled by it. We feel the pull of the mindless herd, the allure of the pack, but we resist the extreme effects of this influence. And when we do not, we drag our societies down into the bloody wreckage of failed utopias led by Hitler or Lenin or Mao Zedong. And the wreckage reminds us that God gave us our individualism, and that to surrender it is to follow a dark path. When we fail to see the eccentricities in ourselves and to be amused by them, we became monsters of self-regard. Each in its own way, every family is as eccentric as mine. I guarantee it. Opening your eyes to this truth is to open your heart to humanity. Read Dickens. He knew. Those in my family don't wish to be anyone but who they are. They will not edit themselves to impress others. They find meaning in their quiet faith, in one another, and in the little miracles of their daily lives. They don't need ideologies or philosophies to define themselves. They are defined by living, with all senses engaged, with hope, and with a laugh ever ready. Almost from the moment I met her in the library, I had known that Lori Lynn Hicks knew everything that Dickens knew, whether she had read him or not. Her beauty lay less in her physical appearance than in the fact that she wasn't a Freudian automaton and would never allow herself to be defined by those terms. She was nobody's victim, nobody's fool. She was motivated not by what others had done to her, not by envy, not by a conviction of moral superiority, but by life's possibilities. I put aside the novel featuring the Elephant Man detective, and I levered myself up from the armchair into the walker. The wheels squeaked faintly. In the kitchen, I closed the door behind myself and went to the wall phone. For a while I stood there, blotting my damp palms on my shirt, trembling. This nervousness was less acute but more profound than anything I had felt while under Punchinello's gun. This was the trepidation of a climber who wished to scale the world's highest mountain in record time, who knows that for a certain window of his life he will have the skills and the physical resources to achieve his dream, but who fears the bureaucrats or storms or fate will foil him until his window closes. And then who will he be? What will he become? During the 6 weeks since the Night of the Clowns, we had spoken by phone many times. I had committed her number to memory. I keyed in 3 digits and hung up. See, he had to commit it to memory because there weren't cell phones. We didn't just have a walking list of contacts at all times. We had napkins and palms. That was really it. No, let me take that back. Once a year, a big-ass book and a little-ass book would arrive on your doorstep. They were called phone books. One was full of businesses and ads and all that kind of stuff, and one was not. The one with all the ads in it obviously was bigger because people would pay money for these ads with their company's telephone number on it. This was called the Yellow Pages. The other one just had numbers, a list of numbers. They were called the White Pages. Back in the day, to find who you were looking for, unless you had a number written down on your hand or on a Rolodex or on a napkin, you had to go through those White Pages. And Lord help us all, if your friend's name was John Smith, just don't even be friends with nobody named John Smith. Y'all in Utah, I both salute and mourn you, because y'all didn't have no way of finding people back then. It's easier now, I guess, for some of us. Some of y'all still got flip phones. I'm not judging you, I'm just saying. Some of y'all got jitterbugs. My mouth had gone dry. I squeaked to a cabinet, got a drinking glass, squeaked to the sink. I drew chilled and filtered water from the special tap. 8 ounces heavier, but still with a dry mouth, I returned to the phone. I keyed in 5 digits, hung up. I didn't trust my voice. I said, "Hi, it's Jimmy." Even I had given up calling myself James. When you realize you're fighting a fundamental law of the universe, it's best to surrender to nature. "Hi, it's Jimmy. I'm sorry if I woke you." My voice had grown shaky and had risen 2 octaves. I had not sounded like this since I was 13. I cleared my throat, tried again, and might have passed for 15. After keying in 6 digits, I started to hang up. Then, with reckless abandon, I punched in the 7th. Lori answered on the first ring, as if she had been sitting by the phone. "Hi, it's Jimmy," I said. "I'm sorry if I woke you. I only got home 15 minutes ago. I'm not in bed yet." "I had fun tonight." "Me too," she said. "I love your family." "Listen, this isn't something that should be done by phone, but if I don't do it, I won't sleep. I'll lie awake worrying that my window's closing and that I'm missing my last chance at the mountain." "All right," she said, "but if you're going to be this cryptic, I better take notes so later I have a chance of puzzling out what the hell you were talking about." "Okay, I got pen and paper. First of all, I'm not much to look at." "Who says?" "Mirror, mirror on the wall. And I'm a lummox." "So you keep saying, but I haven't seen a whole lot of evidence of it, except in moments like this." I couldn't dance before I had those steel plates holding my leg together. Now, I'll have about as much ballroom grace as Dr. Frankenstein's first maid. All you need is the right teacher. I once taught a blind couple to dance. And anyway, I'm a baker, and maybe one day a pastry chef, and that means I'll never be a millionaire. Do you want to be a millionaire? She asked. Not particularly. I'd be worried all the time about how not to lose the money. I should want to be a millionaire, I guess. Some people say that I don't have enough ambition. Who? What? Who says you don't have enough ambition? Probably everybody. Another thing, I'm not much of a traveler. Most people want to see the world, but I'm a homebody. I think you can see the whole world in one square mile if you know how to look. I'm never going to have great adventures in China or the Republic of Tonga. Where's the Republic of Tonga? I don't have a clue. I'll never see Tonga. I'll probably never see Paris or London either. Some people would say that's tragic. Who? In a rush of self-judgment, I said, and I am utterly without sophistication. Not utterly. Some people think so. Them again, she said. Who? Some people, she said. We live in one of the most famous ski resorts in the world, I plunged on. And I don't ski. I never cared to learn. Is that a crime? It reveals a lack of adventurousness. Some people absolutely must have adventure, she said. Not me. And everyone's into hiking and running marathons and pumping iron. I'll never be in that loop. I like books. Long dinners full of talk. Long walks full of talk. You can't talk going 50 miles an hour down a ski slope. You can't talk when you're running a marathon. Some people say I talk too much. They're very opinionated, aren't they? Who? Some people. Do you care what anyone thinks of you outside of your family? Not really. And that's strange, don't you think? I mean, only sociopathic maniacs don't care what anyone thinks of them. Do you think you're a sociopathic maniac? She asked. Maybe I could be. I don't think you could be, she disagreed. You're probably right. You'd have to be adventurous to be a good sociopathic maniac. You have to like danger and change and taking risks, and none of that's me. I'm dull. I'm boring. And this is what you called to tell me, that you're a dull, boring, talkative, unadventurous, failed sociopath. Well, yes, but that's all preamble. To what? To something I shouldn't ask over the telephone. Something I should ask in person. Something that I'm probably asking way too soon, but I've worked myself into this weird, terrifying conviction that if I don't ask you tonight, I'll be foiled by fate or storms, and my window of opportunity will close. So the question is, Lori Lynn Hicks, will you marry me? I thought her silence meant she was speechless with surprise. And then I thought it meant she was teasing me. And then I thought it might mean something darker. And then she said, I'm in love with someone else. Part 3. Welcome to the world, Annie Tock. Chapter 24. The events of September 15th, 1994. When a significant portion of the town square was blown up, encouraged me to take seriously the rest of Grandpa Joseph's predictions. Yeah, that will do it, I think. That would definitely be a good reason. I survived the first of my 5 terrible days, but survival came at a price. Being in your early 20s with a leg full of metal and an occasional limp might be romantic if you're carrying around shrapnel acquired while serving with the Marines. There's no glory in getting shot while struggling with a clown for possession of a pistol. Even if he's a failed clown and a bank robber, he's still enough of a clown to rob your story of heroics and render it absurd. People say things like, so you got the gun away from him, but did he manage to hold on to the seltzer bottle? During the preceding 8 or 10 months, we brooded about and planned for the second day in a list of 5, which came more than 3 years after the first, Monday, January 19th, 1998. As part of my preparations, I bought a 9mm pistol. I don't much like guns, but I'm even less fond of being defenseless. I discourage my family from putting their lives on the line by tying my fate to theirs. Nevertheless, Mom, Dad, and Grandma insist they will be with me all 24 hours of the fateful day. Their primary argument seemed to be that Punchinello Bizzo would not have taken me hostage in the library if he also had to take the three of them hostage with me. Safety in numbers. My response is that he would have shot the three of them dead and taken just me hostage. This elicited from them the weakest possible counterargument, but they always felt that they won the debate with their forcibly expressed interjections. Nonsense! Fiddlesticks! Baloney! Foo! Poo! Poppycock! Bah! Twaddle! Don't be silly! My eye! In your hat! That's pure applesauce! I've never heard anyone use any of these in real life, and I want to start. I'm gonna say poppycock. That's poppycock. That's preposterous. I'd say that's nonsense, but I mean, that's only one. Maybe fiddlesticks. I might be the first black person to say fiddlesticks. They'll want to interview me on Essence Magazine. You can't really argue with my family. They're like the mighty Mississippi River. They just keep rolling. And pretty soon you find yourself in the Delta, drifting along, dazed by the sunshine and the lazy movement of the water. Over many dinners, over uncounted pots of coffee, we debated whether we would be wise to hunker down behind four walls, lock the doors and windows, and defend the homestead against all clowns and whatever other agents of chaos came calling. Mom felt we should spend the day in a public space filled with people. Since there's nowhere in Snow Village where crowds gather around the clock, she proposed flying to Las Vegas and camping out in a casino for two circuits at a clock. Dad preferred to be in the middle of an enormous field with a clear view for a mile in every direction. Grandma warned that a meteorite smashing down out the sky would be just as dangerous if we were in an open field as if we were at home with the doors locked or in Vegas. Nothing like that would happen in Vegas, Mom insisted, drawing conviction from a mug of coffee half as big as her head. Remember, the mob still runs the place. They have the situation controlled. The mob? My father said exasperatedly. Maddie, the mob can't control meteorites. Sure they can, my mother said. They're very determined, ruthless, and clever. Definitely, Grandma agreed. I read in a magazine that 2,000 years ago, a spaceship landed in Sicily. Aliens interbred with the Sicilians, which is why they're so tough. What stupid magazine would publish such twaddle? Dad asked. Grandma replied, Newsweek. Never in a million years would Newsweek publish such nonsense. Well, Grandma assured him, they did. You read it in one of your crazy tabloids. Newsweek. Smiling, I drifted in the Delta as I listened. Days passed, weeks, months, and it became clear, as it had always been, that you can't scheme to defeat destiny. The situation was complicated by the fact that we were pregnant. Yes, I'm aware that some find it arrogant for a man to say we, considering that he shares in the pleasure of conception and the delight of parenthood, but none of the pain between. The previous spring, my wife, who was the linchpin of my life, had happily announced to the family, we're pregnant. Once she had given me license to use a plural pronoun, I embraced it. Because we were able to deduce the date of conception, our family doctor had told us the most likely 48-hour window for delivery would be January 18th and 19th. We were at once convinced that our first child would enter the world on the day about which Joseph had so long ago warned my father, Monday, the 19th, Martin Luther King Day. The stakes were suddenly so high that we wanted out of the game. When you're playing poker with the devil, however, no one leaves a tail before he does. Although we all tried not to show it, we were scared to the extent that we needed no laxatives. As time swept us towards that rendezvous with the unknown, the hope and strength that Lori and I took from family mattered more than ever. As the days go by, it's a deeper love for the family. Let Judy come downstairs, nigga. Chapter 25. My beloved wife is capable of jerking my chain. I'm in love with someone else. And therefore, I jerked yours. Remember, I have learned the structure of story from a family that delights in narrative and understands in its bones the magical realism of life. I know the routines, the tricks. I might be clumsy in other ways, but in writing of my life, I will try my best not to get my head stuck in the bucket. And if the mouse in the pants number comes up, I'm pretty sure I won't be booed out the big top. In other words, hold on. What looks tragic might be comic on second consideration. And what is comic might bring tears in time. Like life. So, flashing back for a moment, there I stood in my parents' kitchen that night in November of 1994, leaning against the counter to avoid putting weight on my cast-bound leg, explaining to Lori that although I wasn't much to look at, although I might be dull and boring and talkative and unadventurous, I hoped that she would be thrilled to marry me. And she said, "I'm in love with someone else." I could have wished her a good life. I could have squeaked out of the kitchen with my walker, lurched up the stairs, taken refuge in my bedroom, and smothered myself to death with a pillow. That would have meant never seeing her again in this life or the next, and I found that prospect intolerable. Besides, I hadn't yet eaten enough pastries to be willing to trade this world for one in which the existence of sugar is not guaranteed by theologians. Keeping my voice steady, determined to sound like a stoic loser who wouldn't think of smothering himself, I said, "Someone else." "He's a baker," she said. "What are the odds, huh?" Snow Village was markedly smaller than New York City. If she loved another baker, surely I knew the guy. "I must know him," I said. "You do. He's very talented. He creates pieces of heaven in his kitchen. He's the best." I couldn't tolerate losing the love of my life and my rightful place in that baker's hierarchy of Snow County. "Well, I'm sure he's a nice guy, you know, but the fact is that around these parts, only my dad's a better baker than me, and I'm closing on him fast." "There he is," she said. "Who?" "The someone I'm in love with." "He's there now? Put him on the line." "Why?" "I want to find out if he even knows how to make a decent pâté sablé." "What's that?" "If he's such a hotshot, he'll know what it is. Listen, Lori, the world is full of guys who will claim they have the stuff to be a baker to kings, but they're all talk. Make this guy put his muffins where his mouth is. Put him on the line." "He's already on the line," she said. "That weird other Jimmy, the one that kept putting himself down and telling me how plain and dull and unworthy he was, I hope he's gone forever." "Oh." "My Jimmy," she continued, "isn't a braggart, but he knows his worth, and my Jimmy will never stop till he gets what he wants." "So," I said, no longer able to keep the tremor out of my voice, "will you marry your Jimmy?" "You saved my life, didn't you?" "But then you saved mine." "Why would we have gone to all that trouble and then not get married?" she asked. 2 Saturdays before Christmas, we were wed. My father stood as my best man. Chilson Strawberry flew in from a bungee jumping tour of New Zealand to be maid of honor. Looking at her, you would never have known that she once crashed face first into a bridge abutment. Lori's dad, Bailey, took a break from storm chasing to get the bride away. He arrived looking windblown, looked windblown in his rented tux, and left looking windblown, marked by his profession. Alyssa Hicks, Lori's mother, proved to be lovely and charming. She disappointed us, however, by arriving without a single snake. In the 3 years following our wedding, I became a pastry chef. Lori changed careers from ballroom dance instructor to a website designer so she could work baker's hours. We bought a house. Nothing fancy. 2 stories, 2 bedrooms, 2 baths. "Really? In a 2-story? There's just 2 bedrooms? That's a lovely downstairs area, I'm guessing. Like, that has to be fantastic if there's only 2 bedrooms in a 2-story house." I'm sorry, I'm picturing that right now. What that will look like. Like, doggone, that kitchen has to be huge. Wow. I want to take the wall down in my front room, but A, I don't fucking know how. And B, I don't want to pay somebody else to do it. And C, it has a support beam in the middle of it. And I don't really know how the fuck that works either. You watch those shows on like HGTV and it'll get you fucked up. You watch those flipping shows like The Flip or Not to Flip and all that, and it'll get you fucked up. It'll have you thinking thoughts. It's like porn for houses. You watch it long enough, you start to believe you could do that shit. Mm-mm-mm. You end up with a hole in your wall. And when we were looking for houses way back when, there was one house that had a huge hole in the ceiling. Not in the ceiling, like the roof. It was a two-story house. From the first floor to the second floor, there was a huge... No, was it? Nope. It wasn't a hole in the ceiling. I'll take that back. It was a hole in the wall. You got to excuse me. That was 15 years ago. It was a hole in the wall. Huge hole in the wall. Like somebody had taken a sledgehammer to it and was like, we're gonna take this wall down. Gorbachev, knock down this wall. And they took like 7 or 8 swings. And then the next thing you knew was that painted next to it in red lettering was, don't lose hope. Nigga, no. First of all, I'm not buying that house. What the fuck? Secondly, I'm not even going to start, so I can't lose hope. If I never begin hope, I can never lose it. But a two-story house with 2 bedrooms, that's amazingly phenomenal. And I don't know how to even picture that in my head. We caught colds, got well, made plans, made love, had raccoon trouble, played lots of pinochle with mom and dad, and we got pregnant. At noon on Monday, January 12th, after 3 hours of sleep, Lori woke up with pain in the lower abdomen and groin. She lay for a while, timing the contractions. They were irregular and widely separated. Because this was exactly 1 week prior to her most likely delivery date, she assumed that she was experiencing false labor. She had had a previous episode 3 days previously. We had gone to the hospital and come home with the baby still in the oven. Don't put your baby in the oven. Not even to dry him after you get him out the tub. It's not a good idea. Use the microwave, it's faster. The spasms were sufficiently painful to prevent her from falling back into sleep. Careful not to wake me, she slipped out of bed, took a bath, dressed, and went to the kitchen. In spite of the periodic abdominal pain, she was hungry. At the kitchen table, reading a mystery that I had recommended, she ate a slice of chocolate cherry cake, then 2 slices of caraway Klugelhoff. For a few hours, the contractions did not become more painful or less irregular. Beyond the windows, the white wings of the sky were molting. Snow descended silently and feathered the trees, the yard. Lori gave little thought to the snow at first. In an ordinary January, snow fell as many days as not. I woke shortly after 4 p.m, showered, shaved, and went to the kitchen as the day slowly faded into our early winter twilight. Still at the table, immersed in the final chapter of the mystery novel, Lori returned my kiss when I bent to her, taking her eyes from the page for only a moment. Then, hey pastry god, would you get me a slice of streusel? During her pregnancy, she had developed numerous food cravings, but at the top of the list were streusel coffee cake and various types of Klugelhoff. This baby's going to be born speaking German, I predicted. Before getting the cake, I glanced through a window on the back door and saw that about 6 inches of fresh powder covered the porch steps. Looks like the weatherman was wrong again, I said. This is more than flurries. Enchanted by the book, Loria failed to notice that the lazy snowfall had turned into an intense, if windless, storm. Beautiful, she said of the ermine view. Then, half a minute later, she stiffened in her chair. Uh-oh. As I began to slice the streusel, I thought her uh-oh referred to a tense development in the story that she was reading. With a hiss, she sucked breath through her teeth, groaned, and let the book fall from her hands onto the table. I turned from the cake to the sight of her suddenly as pale as a snow-mantled world beyond the window. What's wrong? I thought it was false labor again. I went to the table. When did it start? About noon? 5 hours ago, and you didn't wake me? The pain was just in the lower abdomen and the groin like before, she said. But now, across the entire abdomen? Yeah. All the way around your back? Oh, yeah. That specific topography of pain signified genuine labor. I clutched, but only for a moment. Fear gave way to excitement as I considered my impending fatherhood. Fear would have abided with me if I had known that our house was being watched and that a sensitive surveillance device planted in our kitchen had just transmitted our conversation to a listener no more than 200 yards away. Chapter 26. For a woman carrying her first baby, the initial stage of labor lasts 12 hours on average. We had plenty of time. The hospital lay only 6 miles away. "I'll pack the SUV," I said. "You finish the novel." "Give me the streusel." "Should you eat during first stage labor?" "What are you talking about? I'm starved. I intend to eat all the way through the delivery." After giving her the slice of streusel that I had just cut, I went upstairs to fetch the bag that we had pre-packed for her. I climbed the steps of caution and descended with something like paranoia. If there's ever a good time to fall and break a leg, this wasn't it. During 3 years of marriage, I had become markedly less of a lummox than before we had taken our vows. I seemed to have absorbed some of her grace as if by osmosis. Nevertheless, I took no chances as I carried the suitcase into the garage and quickly loaded it in the back of our Ford Explorer. We also had a 1986 Pontiac Trans Am, candy apple red with black interior. Lori looked fabulous in it. After raising the automatic garage a few inches to provide ventilation, I started the Explorer and left the engine running. I wanted the interior to be warm by the time that Lori got aboard. Following a lesser storm 4 days previously, I'd put snow chains on the tires. I had decided to leave them on. Now I felt prescient, competent, and in charge. I figured this was going to be a milk run, thanks to my foresight. Under Lori's mellowing influence, I had become an indefatigable optimist. Before the night was out, I'd pay a price for my optimism. In the mud room between garage and kitchen, I kicked off my shoes and hurriedly put on ski boots. I snared my Gore-Tex Thermalite parka from a wall hook and shrugged into it. I took a similar parka into the kitchen for Lori and found her standing near the refrigerator, groaning. "The pain is worse when I'm moving than when I'm standing still or sitting down," she said. "Then all the moving you're doing is out to the Explorer. At the hospital, we'll get you on a wheelchair." After I had assisted her into the front passenger seat and got the safety harness around her, I returned to the mudroom. I switched off the house lights, pulled shut the door, locked it. I hadn't forgotten the 9mm pistol. I just didn't think I would need it. My second of 5 terrible days was still a week in the future. Considering Grandpa Joseph's track record, it didn't occur to me that he might have gotten the second date wrong, or that he might have only predicted 5 of 6 terrible days. When I got behind the wheel of the Explorer, Lori said, "I love you more than all the streusel and Klugelhoff in the world." I said right back at her, "I love you more than creme brulee and tarte aux mites." "Do you love me more than mungo bean custard?" she asked. "Twice as much." "I'm a lucky woman." As the segmented garage door rumbled upward, Lori winced with a contraction. "I think it's a boy." She had undergone an ultrasound scan to make sure the baby was healthy, but we hadn't wanted to know the gender. I'm all for modern technology, but not if it robs life of one of its sweetest surprises. I pulled into the driveway and discovered that the storm had worked up a little wind. Though only a breeze, it harried the dense snow through the headlights, masking the night with billowing veils. Our house stood along Hawksbill Road, 2 lanes of blacktop that linked Snow Village itself with the resort of the same name. The resort, where Dad and I work, is 1.5 miles to the north, and the outskirts of town lay 5 miles to the south. At the moment, the highway was deserted in both directions. Only road crews, reckless fools, and the pregnant will be out in weather this bad. Not many houses have been built along Hawksbill Road. For most of its length, the rocky and angular terrain flanking the highway is not conducive to construction. In the pocket of more hospitable territory where we live, 5 houses stand on large properties, 3 on our side of the highway, 2 on the east side of the blacktop. We know and are friendly with the neighbors in 4 of those houses. In the 5th, directly across Hawksbill Road from us, live Nedra Lamb, who have been a local character for decades. In Nedra's front lawn stood half a dozen 8-foot-tall totems that she carved from dead wood and accessorized with deer antlers. These grotesque figures faced the highway, threatening a rain of hoodoo violence on unwelcome visitors. Nedra Land was a recluse with a sense of humor. The greeting on the mat at her front door did not say welcome, but commanded, go away. Through the falling snow, I could barely see past her house, a pale shape in a paler landscape. As I followed our driveway to the county road, movement at the land place caught my attention. From the dark hall of her open garage came a rushing shape that at a distance first appeared to be a large pickup truck with headlights off. For more than 38 years, Nedra had driven a 1960 Plymouth Valiant, arguably the ugliest car ever produced by Detroit, which she maintained in pristine showroom condition, as if it were a classic of automotive design. As the oncoming vehicle reached the end of her driveway and raced on the Hawksbill Road, parting the veil to snow, I identified it as a black Hummer, the civilian version of the military Humvee. Big, fast, with four-wheel drive, undeterred by snow and ice, the Hummer turned neither left nor right, but lightless, crossed the highway towards us. What's he doing? Lori wondered. Fearing a collision, I braked, halted. The Hummer slid to a stop at an angle across the driveway, blocking our exit. The driver's door flew open. A man got out. He had a rifle. 916-633-1537, wretched@gmail.com, Wretched Book Club on Twitter, Wretched Book Club on Facebook. You can leave a review on Spotify. It takes like 13 seconds. You can also leave a review on Podchaser. Copy and paste that into Apple Podcasts, and then copy and paste that into the Good Pods app. You can donate to the show at patreon.com/singlesimulcast. $1 will get you a ton of content. You can also donate to the show at buymeacoffee.com/sscast or on the Good Pods app. You can leave a tip in the tip jar. Thank you so much for listening. I greatly appreciate it. Y'all be good. I'm going to holler at you later. Peace. Intro and outro to Ratchet Book Club is by That Kid Garan, and it's called Goodbyes. You can email him at tkgbeats94@gmail.com for more information on how to lease this beat.
This is Single Simulcast.